Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the show. My name is Ben Gothard, your host, and today we have the honor of speaking with Corey Zidell. How are you doing today, Corey?
I'm doing great. That's awesome. You knew my name. We're off to a good start.
To be fair, I did have to ask.
No, definitely not.
Well, Corey, I want to thank you for being here, and I really want to ask you, what is your story?
I have a great story, I think. Horrible student, good person, hard worker, try anything, succeed at most things, failed at a lot of things, never give up. I went to two elementary schools. I went to two high schools. I barely graduated high school. I had some help, some outside help to get through high school. I graduated community college. I went to four colleges. I wound up graduating from University of Maryland College Park, a great institution, proud to have that diploma. And I, with a business marketing degree, and I thought, well, let's do this. I'm the man now. I have a business degree, so now I can go crush business. I had already started a business while in college, and so I had the experience. But what opportunity is there for a 22-year-old with no cash and a student loan without access to lines of capital? Because I don't like to do things small. I'm a big idea guy. So I met some people taking a little break after college, and they were all going to postgraduate school. And so I wanted to learn more about it. What qualifies you to get an advanced degree? Why are you better than me? Why are you doing that instead of working? And I did a lot of research. I talked to a lot of people. I picked their brains. A lot of them came from families who, you know, where there was a doctor, a dad doctor, a mom doctor. There was a grandfather lawyer. You know, there was an MBA in the family blood. That wasn't the case with me. I had hardworking parents, but between the two of them, there's one AA degree from a community college. But they valued education, and I learned to value education as I got older, and I chose law school. And man, when I told my mom I was going to go to law school, the laughter was louder than you could imagine. It's like Eddie Murphy just did Raw for the first time, and no one had seen it before. That's what it was like in the kitchen when I told her I was going to go to law school. And when she realized I was serious, she got serious and said, well, how are you going to do that? I said, well, I've been talking to people. I think I'm qualified. I know I'm smart enough. And law school gives me the best opportunity to train my brain instead of learning information. And so we talked it through. I applied to some schools, and I did get in. And I miserably went through 3 years of law school because learning how to learn and learning how to analyze things is so much different than learning information.
Yes.
Which is what you've been taught the first 12 years of school and then 4 years of college. That matters nothing in law. You do not have to have any information to do law. You have to know how to understand and analyze information. And so that's what I did. 3 years of law school, I learned how to learn information, and my brain kind of functions differently now. I see the world through a different prism than I did when I had a business education. So I'm at a law school and I say, okay, I'm not going to be a lawyer. That's not what I'm going to do with my life. What am I going to do? I'm going to start a business. What business am I going to start? So I started being a lawyer. No capital, no idea. I'm not going to spend my time on something small. I had student loans. Worked for a couple years representing businesses. That wasn't for me. Switched sides, started representing the people, started representing consumers. That was more for me, but it needed to be different. It needed to be scalable. It needed to be something that could make a big difference, where I could represent a lot of people at the same time and have the biggest impact possible. Mm-hmm. So I started my own law firm. 9 years, consumer class actions, representing people who we believe had legal rights violated by big businesses. And I've been pretty successful doing that. But as time has gone by, each year, I've noticed maybe a little less success on an annual basis. I knew it wasn't me. I wasn't getting worse at being an attorney. My clients couldn't have been them. It's not the judges. They're judges until they die. It's the same people. So what was the issue? So that brings us to current. What is my story today? My story is SueThem.com. I created this business to have the largest impact for the most people possible in providing people access to justice. And that's what I'm doing now.
That is a pretty good story, I will say.
Thanks.
So when you were younger, why weren't you a good student?
We've never gotten to the core of the problem. What I know is that I was overactive. I don't like learning things in a formulaic way.
What do you mean by that?
School is meant for the group. It teaches the way that people are taught in school, I believe, from my understanding, is that what is being taught and how it's being taught is so that the most people in that classroom will learn the best way.
Mm.
But I'm not that kind of thinker, and I never have been that kind of thinker. And sitting still for 50 minutes while someone's explaining information, it just wasn't for me. And so I couldn't sit still. I couldn't learn. I was a pain in the ass for the other students. I was horrible to the teachers. I got moved around from class to class. I got put in I was already a Z name, so I was already in the back of the class. But then I'd be put into these carrels, which they don't even use anymore because it's probably considered not appropriate punishment for school. But there'd be a desk. Everyone would have their own desk. And my desk would have wooden panels around it. So no one else could see me. So I couldn't cause trouble, and everyone else could learn. So I was kind of just put off to the side, to the back and to the side, because I was the problem. And it was fine with me because then I didn't have to do anything. So I would just sit in the carrel and not learn anything. But that didn't mean I wasn't smart. I was capable of learning. I just wasn't capable of learning the way they were teaching me. It wasn't until about 11th grade that me and my family reached out for some help on maybe I have a learning issue. And so I have no diagnosed learning issue, but I certainly had trouble learning the general way that people were taught. And in 11th grade, I got some special attention. The school provided me some extra services, and they kind of took me back through those years of school that I completely missed, either due to my own cause or to some teachers not wanting to deal with me. And I hold no grudge against those teachers. I probably would do the same thing to me. What a pain. But anyway, I got that extra help. They kind of taught me what I had been missing out on all those years, and it brought me up to speed. And by the time I graduated in 12th grade, on time, I was caught up.
So how do you learn?
I don't know how normal people learn. I don't know how the average person learns. I learn, I require like a multi-contextual environment.
What does that mean?
I need to hear things, I need to see things, and I need to do things. And so in school, when they'd have you read out of a book, first you have to be able to read, which I had some trouble with. You have to understand it, which I had some trouble with. And you needed the patience to get through the reading and the understanding, which I could not do. For me, it would have been much easier had a teacher explained a concept verbally and then showed it to me on the board visually and then had some type of practical application to do it. Then I think I would have learned it just fine. But learning with 28 people who are also probably better at learning in a standard way, it didn't work for me. So now how do I learn? I spend a lot of time learning. But law school helped a lot because it lets me think differently than get information and store information. Nobody needs information anymore. Information is available at the click of a button, that's in your pocket. Any information you want is there.
Right.
It's how do you process the information thoughtfully and quickly and use it to your advantage is what matters. And law school definitely taught me how to take in massive amounts of information and how to use it.
So how do you do that?
A lot of time. I spend a lot of time. So in any given case, I might have to read thousands of pieces of paper. I might have to research hundreds of cases. I probably will be writing a memorandum of law that's 25 to 50 pages long. And I need to get all the information from everything that I've read onto that paper and in a way that a judge or a clerk can read it and understand it from their perspective, starting at zero. So then I become the teacher. So I teach them the way I wish I would have been taught. I obviously can't give them the verbal unless they give me a hearing. But if I get that hearing, man, they're going to have the whole package. But how do I learn that information? I just spend grueling number of hours trying to process information. And I try to weed out what seems unimportant and highlight what is important. Because I need to know all the information, but the person I'm relaying the information to doesn't need to know all the information. They need to know the important information. And they need to have it in a bundled package that tells the story in as short as possible with getting the message across.
Hmm. That's a very interesting approach to it, of like distilling the core essence out of it and delivering it in a very palatable way.
Right. And most lawyers look at a brief as putting information on a piece of paper and getting your argument before the court. That's not what I do, and that's not what my law firm does. What we try to do is we try to tell the story of what happened to the people who we're representing and then explain why that's a problem. So before they ever get to any law, before they're trying to jump to any judgment on whether there should be some kind of recovery or not, they have some feeling of empathy towards the person that something not perfect has happened. We get that something happened. Okay, we're there now. Now I got to convince them that that thing was wrong, legally. Not just wrong morally, or not just that caused some trouble in life. But once you get a person to understand the issue that the person's dealing with, you have a much easier time explaining how the law should be read in that context. And so that's how I try to present the information that I'm distilling over those thousands of pages. Before we ever get there, we're talking about what was the impact this thing that happened had on the person or people that I'm representing.
Mm-hmm.
And once we get there, then we can talk about, does the law provide some type of remedy for that?
Right.
Should the law provide a remedy for that? Are we going to make it so the law provides a remedy for that? And I've had cases where I've presented this very type of argument where a judge will come forward and say, I understand what happened, and it doesn't seem fair or right, but the law says that this is not illegal, and there's nothing I can do for you. But if Congress should so decide that the law should be different or read differently, they have the right and the power to change that. So what stronger voice than a judge to tell the Congress that maybe something should be done here? My voice isn't going to get that done. Maybe if I have tens of thousands of people on my side, which I'm working on currently, I might be able to get that done. But when a judge writes an opinion and publishes it for the country to see and calls out the Congress and says, maybe, you know, just maybe you should look into this. Not it should be changed, but, you know, this was 20 years ago that you made this law. Maybe times have changed. Maybe you should take a second look. That's a powerful voice that's amplifying your message. And there's no way that would have happened if you wouldn't have had an opportunity to tell the story of the person first. You just jump into the information. Nothing's happening. You get an opinion that says there's no legal violation. Next case.
So I want to talk about how you're building that voice today. But I'm interested in talking a little bit more about this idea of storytelling, and maybe that's not the core of it. Maybe it is, but it seems like your approach to this would be tapping into what you're the best at, your superpower, if you will. Is it storytelling? Is it breaking down the complex and making it simple? Is it teaching? Like, at the end of the day, what is the thing that you do best that enables you to excel in what you're doing?
I think the number one advantage I have in what I do is that I am a business person that has a law degree rather than a lawyer that owns a law firm. And in that, I mean, I think that says it all, but I'll explain it. Because not everyone's a lawyer and not everyone owns a business. You know, in business, you start from an idea and you build around the idea. And in law, you start from your core competency, which is legal practice, and then the business kind of grows around it. And most people that go into law start off working for someone else, learning how the person before them did it, continuing to do that, and each year making incrementally a little bit more money until the older person decides they're not going to do it anymore, and then they take it over and they make a little more money, and then they keep doing it the same way, and then they hire someone and it just keeps going and going and going, where it was Graham Esquire, and then it's Graham and Graham Esquire, then it's Graham and Graham and Graham Esquire, you know, and that's not my vision. My vision is, let's solve a problem with this unbelievable microphone that I have with my law degree. That even though there's, most people would say there's more lawyers than we need in the country, there's not enough business people who are lawyers in the country. There's a lot of lawyers who do the same work, and they do the same work every day, and I do a lot of the same work every day. But I approach my business as a business. Not a profit-seeking institution business, but as a voice of the people. And that voice, when amplified, can create justice and change and provide me a nice profit. But I'm not profit-driven necessarily. So what is it that I do that's different than other lawyers? Is I take this megaphone that I have, which is what people know as class action lawsuits, and I shine a light on what's happening in this country. I tell the story about people who are getting ripped off by businesses, who believe that they're being ripped off by businesses, to be determined by a judge or an arbitrator. And I give them a voice by aggregating people. So instead of filing the case on behalf of this one person, we're coming in with a group. This person, along with 5,000 other people, this happened to all of them, and it needs to stop. So check that box, get it to stop. Box number two is, what relief can they get? And almost always, if I file a class action lawsuit on behalf of consumers and there's merit to the case, meaning what I'm saying in the lawsuit is true, the practice that we believe to be illegal, whether it was illegal or not illegal, that practice ends within a matter of weeks. So talk about justice. And we can provide justice to a large group of people, and not just the people who were injured or potentially injured, but future customers of that business. So I don't look at any case as I'm representing one person or I'm representing 5,000 people who were harmed. I'm looking at it as I just fixed something, hopefully I just fixed something that was potentially going to harm tens of thousands of people in the future.
Right.
So that's the way we look at our cases. Now, the issue that we came across in trying to seek this justice for people is that it's becoming harder and harder to keep class actions in courts, because big businesses insert arbitration clauses and class action waivers in their terms of service, in their credit contracts, in their wireless service provider agreements, in their independent contractor agreements, in their employment agreements. And so you file a class action and it doesn't turn into a search for the truth or a search for justice. It turns into, can we be in court or can we not be in court? And once you're out of court, you don't have a group of people anymore. You just have your one person, and your megaphone was destroyed. You go to a private process with one client against a very large company who's well-staffed and well-resourced, who's going to fight you to the death against one person. So I thought, let's solve this problem from a business perspective. Let's aggregate consumers who've been affected. Mm-hmm. So we file the class action and we try to be in court. But when the company comes forward and says, no, you can't be in court. No, you can't have a class action. No, you can't consolidate. No, you can't aggregate claims. We say, okay, let's go to suethem.com and let's sign people up individually. And they'll have their own case against the big business. But instead of coming as one person, they're coming as thousands of people. So we have that same megaphone. We have built our own megaphone privately against businesses that we believe are not treating their customers in the fairest of ways.
So instead of having 5,000 people under one roof, you have 5,000 people with 5,000 different roofs.
I like that number 5,000, but I like 50,000 more. I like 100,000 even more. I'd take 1 million. I have cases that affect 300 million people. I'm sorry, not in one case, but there's four cases that when combined, it's the same action against different companies, affect almost every adult American in this country. Mm-hmm. They all qualify to sign up at my website. And should they all sign up, I will represent every single one of them individually in their own case against the company, but they will all be filed at the same time. So instead of being in court, and this is what I don't understand. You could be in court fighting this case against one person who's representing everyone, but you're saying, no, we don't want that. Because in their minds, they think what's going to happen is what we're going to wind up fighting is one person privately. So I say, okay, I know I'm not going to have 300 million people sign up. That would be awesome, but that's not going to happen. But if 10,000 people, 20,000 people, 30,000 people sign up, and all their claims get filed on the same day, it's the same megaphone that would have been in court. I guarantee that practice is going to end. And then they're going to have the opportunity to decide the fate of their own case. They can decide whether they want the truth or not. They can decide whether they want money or not. Sometimes that can coexist. They don't have that same control in court in a class action because they're relying on the attorney and the representative. So here I'm giving people access to justice, which they otherwise would not have had. I'm giving them a voice in arbitration individually, and I'm allowing them to aggregate as a group without actually becoming a group. So they have support of their friends and family and peers. They're all doing it together. They don't feel like they're alone and coming at a big company by themselves. And it's been 3 months so far, but people seem to be responding.
That's amazing. And I would actually even argue to say that the megaphone is even bigger when it's not just one person that the company has to deal with. I mean, that's 5,000 separate cases going on. I know I'm stuck on the number 5,000, but yeah. 50,000 individual things that company has to deal with. To me, that's a much bigger megaphone.
Right. And when one person files a complaint, that's an allegation. I think we can all agree that's an allegation.
Right.
When 5,000 or 10,000 people make the same allegation and believe the same thing happened to them, I'm not so sure it's an allegation anymore. It starts to already tilt toward being truth. And so, you know, that's part of this process is if in fact what we're saying is true, if what we're saying is false, then no one should sign up.
Right.
Because it didn't happen to you, you don't qualify. In order to qualify, you have to answer that this happened to you. So if 10,000 people come forward and say this happened to them, that's the ultimate megaphone. I mean, that's almost like the bully pulpit. They're standing at the mic with the country's attention and talking through me and now through themselves in the group. And they're saying, this needs to change. It needs to stop immediately. And we need to find out whether we're entitled to money. And, you know, if I can accomplish one or all of those things, then my mission has been accomplished.
So I'm curious, because of the of your path of being a businessman first and equipping yourself with a law degree, why is justice so important to you? Why was this the path, this the problem that you wanted to solve?
So no one goes into law school thinking that they're going to represent consumers against big business. And if they do, they're lying, because they don't even know you can do that. But I have always been an advocate for myself and for others when it comes to consumer transaction. I owned a business prior to law school. I wanted to treat people fairly. I own a law firm now. I want to treat people fairly. I have employees. I want to treat them fairly. I want them to feel like they're being treated fairly. So how do I get to justice? I mean, there's a lot of things that led me down the path to what I'm doing now. And part of it was that as I was being laid off from every job that I'd ever had over the course of my entire life, I fell into working for a law firm who was doing this, but just on kind of a smaller scale. And I saw that the big voice could really help. So if I get overcharged on a loan, if I make a payment on time and I get charged a late fee because they process my payment later than when I paid it, and I call the company, probably the company is going to say, oh, our bad, we'll give you that back. But don't you think they probably did that to more than just me? And don't you think a lot of people think, well, for $19, it's not worth my time? I don't feel that way. My thought process is, in business, you're worth what your customers agree you're worth. If your customer agrees to pay you X number of dollars for a service and you charge them one penny more than that and won't give it back to them, you have ripped them off. If it's a fraction of a penny, I have a problem with it. That is on the street, that's what we call a robbery. In business, that's what they call overcharging. I don't get it. I don't know how a business can take money from someone they're not entitled to, regardless of the amount, and not have a care about it. And it drives me. I want to reposition the money to the person it belongs to. And I'm not always right. Sometimes I'm actually proven wrong. And I'll have to call my client and say, we filed this case. We thought that you were being overcharged. It turns out you're not being overcharged. And sit down with them and explain to them why we were wrong. That happens.
But then you're at the truth.
We got to the truth. That's what I want to get to, and that's what my clients want. And that's what we think justice is the truth. If we get to the truth, everything else should work itself out. The problem we have right now is getting to the truth. And I think that SueThem.com is going to be a catalyst for truth. I think it's going to get to the end of the case and get to the story. Who should have, did something happen that was wrong? And if it did, who should have the money that was acquired from that wrong? And I hope people join me.
Well, I want to say thank you very, very much, Corey, for coming on the show today and sharing everything that you have. I have one last question for you, then we'll wrap it on up. But what question should I be asking you that I just wouldn't think to ask?
If you want to own a business, why haven't you done it already? And why do you think it's too late to do it now? I think, you know, we're talking about my business, but when we're talking about business in general, there are people who are meant to work for themselves. There are idea people. There are certain people that are wired to be employees, and they love it, and they do a great job. And there's some people that are meant to work for themselves. And the reason that they're not working for themselves is hard to comprehend, other than they can't pull the trigger. And the person thinks, oh, it's too late. I already have a great job and I'm doing great and I don't want to give that up. Or it's, I don't have the money, so I can't get started now. And that's kind of where I was at the end of business school. And I'm glad that it worked out the way it worked out, because now I have this bazooka on my shoulder called a law degree that allows me to amplify my knowledge and to run a business that many people can't. But man, that's a question I think you should ask any person who owns a business or doesn't own a business. Why have you not started your own business? What was the reason that you didn't start your own business? And why do you think it's too late to start now? Like, today is the best day to choose to start your business. 5 weeks ago also was a great day to do it. But it's never a bad day to do it.
I agree.
It's never too late.
I agree 100%. And I want to, again, thank you very much, Corey, for coming on the show. And I want to thank everybody who's watching and listening. Your time is very valuable, so I'm very grateful that y'all choose to share it with us today. So thank you very much. Thank you, Corey, and I will see all of you on the next episode. Take care now.